The real threat to free speech now, I think, is conformism and cowardice.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Brendan O'Neill. He is the editor of Spiked, and he's a columnist at Reason. Brendan, thanks for coming over from England to America.
Hi, Nick. How's it going?
Let's start first about speech. You write a lot about speech. What do you think is the biggest enemy or opponent of free speech today?
The biggest enemy, I don't think it's the state. It used to be the state. The state would kind of smash its boot down on any idea or ideology that it thought was dodgy or questionable or dangerous. Now, that still happens, particularly in Europe. We have hate speech laws, which have seen kind of religious people being arrested and critics of Islam being fined. So that stuff still happens. But the real threat to free speech now, I think, is conformism and cowardice and a reluctance among ordinary people, students, people in the workplace, everyday people, to have the debate out, to take risks intellectually, to express what's in their minds out loud. So there's a real kind of culture of conformism.
So is that conformism, is it enforced through actual codes or disciplinary processes, or is it more kind of Foucauldian, where you're self-centering and, you know, on a campus, it's, you don't want to be shamed or you don't want to look like an idiot by actually speaking up for what you believe?
I think it's the interplay between those two things. The thing that strikes me about campus culture at the moment, everyone blames these crazy purple-haired students who are just intolerant of anything that goes against their way of thinking. But it actually has a long history, you know, certainly back to the late 80s, early 90s, when in America you had speech codes spreading across campuses, as you guys will know. In Britain, we had the no platform policy, which is where the student union movement officially no platformed racists and Zionists and others.
No platform meant you didn't allow them to
speak. You wouldn't allow them to speak on your campus. So those policies have been gaining ground for 20, 30 years. So today's students are the kind of bastard children of that movement. So I think they inherit that kind of reluctance to have open debate, but they also have internalized it. So they have internalized the idea that to say something controversial is the same as punching someone in the face. Mm-hmm. To express a shocking point of view is a form of violence. So I think it's an interplay between the kind of pressure that's been growing over the past 30 years not to say anything judgmental or alarming, and also the kind of internalization of that.
Does it matter in a larger political sense? I mean, in the US anyway, it seemed just as political correctness and tenured radicals, as they were called, took over the university. American politics went very much to the right, really, and even now it's much more to the right of center than it was 20 or 30 years ago. So is this all just kind of shadow play? And then when you get out in the real world, everything goes.
I think it does matter. I think political correctness is quite right wing. This is the great myth in my, I would say this as a kind of lefty, libertarian, old school Marxist, I suppose. I don't think political correctness is left wing, certainly not any kind of left wing idea that I would recognize. I think it's a very conservative idea in the sense that it's about putting a lid on controversies, stamping down heated debate, risky ideas, anything that might kind of rattle the apple cart. So I find PC very conservative. I think it has more to do with the old-fashioned conservative right than it does with the radical left. You know, if you think of the left in the 60s and 70s in particular, they spoke entirely in the language of liberation, national liberation, women's liberation, gay liberation. It's only quite recently that the left has adopted the language of being kind of anti-liberal, pro-state, wanting to squash dangerous ideas.
Right, and puritanical, which leads us to talking about the environment. I think one of the great things coming out of Spiked and your writing in particular is this critique of left-wing environmentalism as really puritanical. Like, why should anybody be anti-consumption, especially for the third world?
Yeah, I hate environmentalism. I mean, it's my least favorite ideology. It's an apology for poverty. It's a justification for unequal development across the world. But you can't come out and say, I oppose economic growth in Africa, because that would be a bit racist. So instead, you have to doll it up in these kind of very PC, left-wing, acceptable-sounding terms, like protecting the environment, saving the planet. But it is about preventing people from growing, from progressing, from having the kind of industrial leap forward that we in the West enjoyed 200 years ago.
Do you worry at all about things like climate change?
Or no. I grew up on this stuff. I mean, firstly, as a Catholic, I grew up with this whole end of worldism, the idea that the world would end and you would be judged for your behavior. This is not a new idea. We just have a secular version of it now. I also grew up in the 80s, early 90s, when we had the nuclear bomb scare, when we were taught how to hide under the table, what foods to store. So this apocalypticism
right.
is not new. It's just being given a kind of lick of paint to make it look fresh. It's the same idea that has informed humanity for a long period of time, which is that our behavior will come back to haunt us. And I think the environmentalists make the same argument.
Is there a meaningful difference between a Catholic priest lecturing you about, you know, the end days are upon us, or there will be a day of judgment, and, you know, a Barack Obama or John Kerry in Paris at the climate change conference saying something similar?
There is a difference. The Catholic priest is infinitely preferable, because what the Catholics promised was transcendence. You would go through hell on earth, you would be judged, you would be shouted at by God, but then you would transcend it and have this wonderful afterlife. The environmentalists promise nothing. You must curb your human footprint, you must recycle, you must stop eating and growing and being a greedy human being. And what do you get in return? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So environmentalism is even worse than the old religions, because it doesn't even promise transcendence as a payback for your curbing of your behavior.
You are making a strong case. I suspect there will be a lot of Catholics who sign up back with the church after this. What about with ISIS and terrorism? England or Britain is infused with this stuff even more than the United States. I mean, we recently had a terrorist attack in California. You guys live with it in a different way. What is going on that Muslims living in Britain get radicalized, some portion of them, and then go berserk, literally?
Yeah.
And what do you do to curb that?
Yeah, it's not just Britain, it's Western Europe. There is a real problem. I mean, you know, after the Paris attacks, some people were saying, well, why doesn't France bomb Belgium? That's where this idea grew. That's where it took hold. I think it's not so much the lure of the Islamic State as it is the push of our own societies. Western European societies have lost any sense of how to socialize the next generation, inspire them, make them feel part of a liberal, democratic, enlightened Western project.
But now, everybody in Europe, though, will say, you know, no, we're doing that. We're letting them maintain their lifestyle that they left. We're fining people or throwing people in jail who say bad things about Islam. Why is that the wrong way to go about kind of creating a new society that's inclusive?
That is beyond the wrong way to go about it, because what that does, the punishment of Islamophobia in particular, the clamping down on anyone who criticizes Islam, that actually fuels the victim mentality among some young radical Muslims who think that the West is out to get them, their own society hates them. I mean, think about the Charlie Hebdo massacre. Everyone was thinking, oh, this is some foreign attack in France. But actually, I think it was a very French attack. This is a country in which it's actually against the law, potentially, to criticize Islam, or particularly Muslims. People have been dragged to court. Charlie Hebdo itself had been taken to court for religious hatred. These guys who killed the Charlie Hebdo cartoonist grew up in a country that told them it is really bad for people to offend your religious faith. And then we wonder why they acted in the way that they did.
Do you see terrorism in the West really as part of a problem with the West turning its back on enlightenment, or the idea of a universal an understanding of cosmopolitanism and people living together with different views, different ideas, but in a peaceful way?
Yeah, I think the terrorist problem in the West is primarily a product of our abandonment of the Enlightenment. I think the Charlie Hebdo massacre, that was the armed wing of political correctness. These are products of a society that has abandoned the idea of freedom of speech, abandoned the idea of democracy, abandoned the idea of real robust debate, and it tough luck if it harms your feelings. And in that climate, you give rise to new groups who are super sensitive, who think everything that goes against their way of life should be crushed. Now, it might express itself peacefully on campus, where they want a safe space, people out of existence. But among some groups, it expresses itself far more violently.
How do you change that dynamic, not just in terms of religious speech and Islam, but more broadly? How does the West kind of re-embrace an Enlightenment ideal of progress and of tolerance and pluralism without it becoming a kind of horror show of enforced, an enforced march towards progress with a capital P?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And I think at the moment we're getting it wrong. I mean, if you look at France again, they've banned the burqa as a kind of attempt to defend French Republican values. But in fact, what they're doing is undermining liberty and freedom of choice and the right of women to dress as they please. So in the very process of trying to enforce Enlightenment values, they actually undercut them. And that's happening across Western Europe at the moment. The only way our leaders seem capable of enforcing Enlightenment values is in a very clumsy, cack-handed way. And in fact, the whole idea of enforcing Enlightenment values is a contradiction in terms. We need to enthuse people about them. We need to stand up for them more robustly. We need to argue for them in free, open debate rather than silencing or imprisoning the enemies of Enlightenment.
You've described yourself in the past as a kind of libertarian Marxist or a Marxist libertarian. What does that mean? What's the Marxist and what's the libertarian part?
It's kind of, I usually say it just to wind people up because it seems like a contradiction in terms, but that's because people haven't read any original Marx or Engels, the early stuff. You know, I'm like people with rock bands, they say like, I prefer the early stuff. I'm the same with Marxism. If you read that early stuff, it's all about liberating humanity from poverty and from state diktat and allowing them to have as free a life as possible. My rallying cry is Trotsky's rallying cry. He said we have to increase the power of man over nature and decrease the power of man over man. I would challenge anyone to find a better description of progressive politics than that. And that is Spike's rallying cry. We want to increase the power of man over nature and decrease the power of man over man.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about Spike. How did it come about and what's its kind of mission statement?
Spiked is about 15 years old. We grew out of a magazine called Living Marxism, which was shut down in a notorious libel trial in London in the late 1990s. Spike's mission is really just to inject some progressive Enlightenment values into public debate in Europe and across the world.
And yet, what's interesting is that in England it might be progressive values. Over here it's almost always seen as libertarian.
Yeah.
And what do you think explains the idea? And I guess it's similar to the way that being a liberal here is different than being a liberal in Europe, but you know, your vision of progressivism is really kind of libertarian in an American context.
Yeah, well, there's a real conflict of terminology across the pond. I think the real way to measure someone's moral worth these days, which is a terrible thing to say, is what is their point of view on freedom? Where do they stand on liberty? Because that tells you what people thinks about humanity itself. Do they trust people to have the freedom to say and hear everything and to make up their minds for themselves about the moral value of those ideas? Or do they not trust them and instead think that the state or some other body should control what we can say, hear, and do? That's the dividing line now. It's no longer left and right. It's no longer are you free market or anti-free market. It's where do you stand on trusting people to exercise their moral autonomy? That, I think, is the great thing about alliances between people like Spiked and Reason. We come from different sides of the old-fashioned spectrum, but we share a belief in people's ability to exercise freedom on their own.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Brendan O'Neill. He's the editor of Spiked. He writes at Reason and about a billion different outlets. Please look him up. Brendan, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Nick.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.